I'd like to thank you all for coming here tonight for the Politics, Philosophy and International Thought Research Group's annual lecture. This lecture comes as a part of and the conclusion of a series of reading sessions we've been doing on the philosophy of space and place. Those of you who've attended will know that our readings took us through the works of Marx, Foucault and Heidegger in order to try and work out a little bit about how questions of place, space and perhaps territory impact upon our thinking about international thought and politics and indeed philosophy more generally. And I think we've been able to secure a speaker tonight who speaks to all of these thinkers and all of these themes. And so we're very honoured to have Professor Stuart Eldon of the Department of Geography of Durham University here to speak for us tonight. Stuart is the author of 4 books and the editor of 7, according to his own excellent blog, Progressive Geographies. And I suggest you all follow this because it is a truly a kind of an inspiring experience seeing the breadth of material and engagement Stuart makes in the course of simply a day. I think I counted that he's made at least 4 blog posts since he's been in Aberystwyth last night. And if I could engage with that many things in the amount of time that he does, then I'm sure I'd have finished my PhD by now. Stuart's books include 2001, Mapping the Present, Heidegger, Foucault, and the Project of Spatial History, which I think was based on his PhD thesis, which was done at Brunel University in London. 2004, Understanding Henri Lefebvre, Theory and the Possible. 2006, Speaking Against Number, Heidegger, Language and the Politics of Calculation. And 2009, Terror and Territory, The Spatial Extent of Sovereignty. And imminently, just about to come out, is his latest book, The Birth of Territory. And we asked him initially to come here and speak about that tonight, but like kind of all committed and forward-thinking scholars, he's actually already thinking about the next project. So this is what he's going to be speaking about tonight, his new project, Shakespearean Territories. When I initially was planning what to say to introduce him, I was going to do what Hidemi Suganami sometimes does and find all the books that Stuart had written in the library and pile them up in front of me. But I couldn't do that because the library doesn't have any of them. Now, that's not an indictment of Aberystwyth University's library system, but I think actually a validation of Stuart's scholarship because they're all on loan. And it shows that Stuart's books are being read right across the university. And I think testament to a scholar is who and where his books are read. And his books have been translated into French, German, Spanish, Italian, Croatian, Russian, and Hebrew. But in addition to the wide range of languages in which they're read, the thing about Stuart's scholarship is it's read in many different disciplines. It's read by people in international politics, political philosophy, geography, history, sociology, philosophy, and perhaps with this project it also starts to speak to issues of performance and literature as well, if it didn't already speak to those. And so with that being the case, I'd like to hand over to Stuart to talk for about 50 minutes or so about Shakespearean Territories, the Political Bodies of Coriolanus. He's been kind enough to give time for about half an hour, 40 minutes for questions and answers at the end. So we'll move on to that when Stuart is done. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom, for that very generous introduction. It's very nice to be back here. I seem to come to Aberystwyth every few years, which is always a great pleasure. I have a number of friends here in different departments. It's always great to see people and to meet a new generation of PhD students, which is always an impressive thing to meet and to hear about the interesting projects that are being done by them. So territory has been a question I've been working on in a number of different registers for a number of years. And 3 sort of main areas in which my work on territory has been operating. Naturally, perhaps some very political work on the question of territory, thinking about territory in relation to globalisation, thinking about whether the European Union has constituted itself as a territory, thinking about the international legal notion of territorial integrity, and particularly what's happened to the international notion of territorial integrity in the so-called War on Terror, or in the last sort of 20, 25 years or so. And the Work in Progress seminar that I'm going to give tomorrow tries to use some of the work I've been doing around those questions in relation to what's happening in Nigeria at the moment with the Boko Haram group and some of the questions about politics in Nigeria. A number of other pieces of work I've done on the question of territory have been in a much more conceptual register to suggest that territory is a concept that requires much more thought than has generally been the case. That while there is a lot of existing work on particular territories, there's not been so much work on the concept of territory, how that concept relates to practices of territorialisation or state territorial strategies, thinking about territory in relation to other political concepts and other geographical concepts. And that kind of work, I've tried to make some interventions in terms of how we might think about the question of territory as a concept rather than as simply something that plays out in different places in different times. And then over the last 10 years or so, the main project, even though I've set it aside at various points to do other things, the main project has been to write a history of the concept of territory. And to do this historically, a rereading of Western political thought in a very expanded sense of what the tradition might be, to think about the emergence of this concept as a particular way of ordering the relation between place and power. That there are many ways of ordering that relation, not all of which go under the name of territory, not all of which are related to our modern concept of the question of territory. And the conclusion, or the sort of provisional sense, because I don't want this to be a final definition that's perhaps better or worse than other definitions of it, but as a way of thinking about it to raise the questions that we need to ask about territory. To think about territory in the way that Foucault talks about the notion of population, as a political technology, or perhaps as a bundle of political technologies comprising a variety of different elements that come together in different ways at different times, that coalesce in different types of forms, or what might be called assemblages, or Foucault's notion of an apparatus. To try to think about ways that territory is not simply an economic concept, the notion of land, and not simply a strategic concept, what we might call the concept of terrain, but it also involves questions in the legal register, in the way that we think about particular kinds of techniques, so about population censuses, about large-scale land surveys, about cartography, about how these particular kinds of techniques, dependent on certain types of skills, allow the concept of territory to emerge and to be put into practice by political actors. So territory, yes, of course, a political concept, yes, of course, a geographical concept, but also one that we need to interrogate in some other registers, including the economic, the strategic, the legal, and the technical. And what I'd say in sense of a kind of a self-critique of the work that I've done up until this point, there are other registers to the question of territory that I've not explored so much. And I'm going to say a little bit about those in this evening's lecture. To think about territory as something that has affective properties, emotional attachments, the senses of bodies and what those bodies do in singular or in plural within particular spaces, of places embodied and bodies within places, and how we might think about territory in that register. And so the two books that I've written on the concept of territory, one a very political book, a very up-to-the-minute book that was engaging with the War on Terror and a range of associated practices and events, and then a very historical book that looks at the emergence of that concept in Western political thought. And that book is an extremely long book, it's an extremely historical book, and I think in a sort of self-critical mode I'd say it's a pretty dry book, that it engages with a range of historical texts, a range of theoretical texts, to try to trace where this particular emergence of our modern concept of territory comes from, out of a whole range of different strands within that political tradition. And that the big surprise for me in writing the book, and my sense is if you are not surprised in the writing of a book, you should be doing something else. The surprise for me was how important the Middle Ages became in that book. And that what was initially intended to be a single chapter on the Middle Ages, so that I didn't do that sort of fast forward from Aristotle to Machiavelli or from Aristotle to Descartes, depending on either the political or the philosophical way, what became a chapter and expanded and became two and eventually ended up as being over half of the book. And that in the medieval period, a number of very modern notions seem to emerge out of a whole set of debates, and that this is what I try to trace in that book about how these questions come about. And it's a very big book. It's a book that is 200,000 words in length, probably be about 500 pages when it's actually printed, and that was the manuscript shortly before I put it in the envelope to send to Chicago. Now, I had a plan then of doing something completely different with the next project. I thought I was really done with the question of territory. There was nothing more that I had to say about the question of territory. I was going to move on. I had a project I wanted to do about concepts and practices of the world. I had a long dormant set of notes on Foucault that I wanted to write up into a book on Foucault. But I kept getting drawn back to the question of territory, both in a political register but also theoretically. Because towards the end of the eighth chapter of the book, there was a short reading of Shakespeare's King Lear. And it was around the opening scene of Shakespeare's King Lear, where King Lear says to his daughters that he wishes to divest himself of rule, interest of territory, cares of state. And so I thought it would be interesting to offer a short reading of King Lear in this historical book about the way that in the late 16th, early 17th century, the concept of territory might be understood. Now, as with many things that I work on, it became far too big. It didn't fit in the space that I'd allotted to it in the book, and I realised that there was a separate paper on that question. And that in reading King Lear, I realised there were things to be said about some of Shakespeare's other plays around the question of territory. So I started to develop a reading of Richard II. I started to do some work on Hamlet and the kind of the geopolitics of Hamlet, as opposed to the internal court politics, to talk about Hamlet in relation to what's going on in the wider region between Norway and Poland and so on. And I began to realise that there might be something more to do with this question and to think around these ideas in a particular way. Now, if you simply are looking in Shakespeare for the instances of the word territory, you'll find very little. Shakespeare uses the word territory only twice, and once of those is only in the folio edition of the text rather than the quarto edition. The plural territories appears in a number of more instances, but still relatively rare. The word is still a relatively rare word in political vocabulary at Shakespeare's time. In a sense, it's not particularly surprising that the word is not used terribly often in his own plays. But it seemed to me that if we broaden the question of territory to think about a whole range of associated questions, a number of them structure several of Shakespeare's plays. They work in a number of different ways around this. If you think about questions of exile and banishment, the contestation over territory, land politics, the political economy of land, spatial division, conquest and so on, many of Shakespeare's plays open up to thinking about those kinds of questions. And so what the proposed book actually does is to try to think about different aspects of the question of territory by offering readings of particular plays by Shakespeare to open up those kinds of questions. So to look at the economic question through the arguments about what Richard II is doing to his kingdom, about whether he is no longer the king of England but the landlord of England, that he is leasing it out as a tenement or a pelting farm, as is the accusation that is made of him. To think about the colonial question by reading not simply The Tempest, which is the classical play that people look at on the question of colonialism, but to try to read Pericles as a colonial play, to try to read Antony and Cleopatra in that register, or to think about what's actually happening in Othello. Where is Othello for most of the play, and how has Othello made his political standing in Venetian society? It's as a military leader, and he's sent to Cyprus for the vast part of that play. Cyprus is a contested territory in the Eastern Mediterranean between Venice and Turkey, the Ottoman Turk, that is seen as that kind of colonial outsider through that play. So the idea was that by doing these readings of particular plays, I could open up questions around the idea of territory that would perhaps work for a different kind of audience to the rather dry historical study that I'd written in At the Birth of Territory. Now, when I've been talking about this project, what I've been doing is to talk only about a single part of the project, because I don't have the time to go into the kind of detail that I'm attempting with each of those readings. And that I thought, coming to Aberystwyth, particularly because you had the performance here and you've had workshops on it, that I would talk about the second chapter of this book and offer a reading of Coriolanus. Coriolanus is often looked at as one of Shakespeare's most political plays. It's a play that has an explicit political contestation right at the beginning. While it's set in ancient Rome, there's something going on in terms of the grain riots. There's starving people in the community, and they're petitioning Coriolanus, a military leader, to allow them access to the grain stores within the city of Rome. And that Coriolanus, as a military leader, is resisting against the way that the people want to have something, as he sees it, for nothing in this instance. And so various readings of the play have been developed in terms of what's actually Shakespeare trying to say in terms of the context in which he is writing the play. In 1607, in England, there were popular uprisings about the problem around the corn getting to people and the riots that were associated with those actions at the time. And Shakespeare, in the play, gives voice both to the common people who are arguing with the patriarchs of Roman society and to those patriarchs themselves. And so a variety of people have read the play in different ways, favouring one or other of these two sides within these overall arguments. It was suggested, for example, in the 19th century that there was no need for people to read the work of either Edmund Burke or Thomas Paine or to listen to debates in the House of Commons. They could simply read Shakespeare and they would get a representation of those different types of arguments about the relation between the people and the state. In the 20th century, T.S. Eliot and Bertolt Brecht both wrote very different political versions of the play in their own writings, interpreting it either in a semi-fascist version, as T.S. Eliot did, or for a Marxist reading, as Bertolt Brecht did. But one of the things that's interesting about the play, it seems to me, is that it transcends any straightforward sense of a kind of a party politics or a left versus right politics, but it raises a whole range of questions about what it means to be part of a political community, what the relation is between the citizen and the body politic, what it means to do with having the question of dearth, of a political crisis inside of a community, in terms of the relation between external enemies and the internal threats that emerge within a society. Now, I know a number of you may know the play or may know the recent film version, the Ralph Fiennes version that came out a couple of years ago, but I'm going to give you a brief plot summary just so that then the things I say about the play later will fit within that context. Caius Marcius is a victorious Roman general, but intensely disliked by the people. He's seen as one of the reasons behind their hunger, while the rest of the city, the patriarchs, are living in luxury and the grain stores are full. There's an encounter between the people and Caius right at the beginning, and Caius is very scornful of their claims. This then leads into a larger geopolitical struggle where Caius Marcius, the Roman general, leads the victorious Roman army against the Volscians at the city of Corellii. Now, he's fighting there against what seems to be his arch-enemy, Tullius Aufidius, and in the encounter between these two, in the fight between them, they are dragged away by their own sides. They don't fight to the death in that particular instance. Caius defeats the Volscians. Because he's defeated them in the city of Corellii, he is given the honorific name of Coriolanus, the vanquisher of that city. He's given that as his honorific name and then takes on the name that he has through the rest of the play as this person who's named by the city they have defeated in this war. He decides to run for political office within Rome, to use his military power turning into a civilian political power. But he meets with opposition from some of the other people, politicians within the city, particularly the two tribunes, Junius Brutus and Secunius Velutus, who conspire against him and turn the mass of the people against him. The way that Coriolanus reacts to this is seeing this as being dismissive of what he has achieved for Rome, of them not recognising the contribution that he has made to the city, not recognising the things that he himself has sacrificed, the number of wounds that he wears on his body as marks of what he has done for Rome. He sees this as being dismissive and unfair. He argues with the people, he says various things, gets accused of treason, and is banished from the city. And he's condemned initially to execution, but is commuted into that question of banishment. And he leaves, and this is quite a peculiar motive that he has here, in that his decision is to go to the Volscian city of Antium to hand himself over to his archenemy in order that he can be put to death by them as a way of spiting his own Roman compatriots back in his city. But instead what happens is that these two men, previously enemies, decide to band together and attack Rome. So he's leading an attack against his home city as a response to this rejection in a political register, despite his contributions in a military register. And he gets persuaded against this course of affairs, not by the other politicians, not by his wife, not by his son, but by his mother. And there is this long speech where his mother is persuading him that he should not turn against the city of Rome, the city that, like her, had given birth to him, that had created him. This is not something he should do, of committing effectively matricide against his home city. And that he is persuaded against this course of action, and as a consequence is put to death by the Volscians. Now, these political questions, then, it's not a kind of a stretch to read a political argument into this play. The play is inherently political, the language is inherently political. Those kinds of questions of the relation between the city and its people, between the people in positions of authority and the people as a whole, these kind of questions run throughout the play. They structure the narrative, they structure the language that's being used within the play. Now, what I want to try and do is to unpick some of these questions around the ideas of bodies in the play, political bodies. Bodies both in the sense of the body politic, but also the political bodies, the bodies of the political actors within the play, but also to try to think about the way that the play uses language around the idea of animals and animal bodies, to think about the wounds that people wear on their bodies, the marks, the scars of war that these people have and are asked to display in public show, to show what they have done on behalf of the city, to show the sacrifices that they have made for there. And then to pull out of that the way that we might be able to think about the idea of the city as a kind of a political body, about the political community as a political body, and around the relation of the question of territory to the idea of the body. So the idea of bodies has been discussed in relation to the play before. So some of what I say here will be very familiar to people who know the existing literature on the question of the play. A lot of this language of bodies is so overt that it's not surprising that this has been examined and mined by people before. But I hope that some of the things that I'm saying around the question of territory, and to try to think about that question in relation to the play and how that plays out in a kind of a corporeal, bodily sense, might add something to those existing readings and so on. Now, as I mentioned, there's the Ralph Fiennes version of Coriolanus, and I'll make a few references to that as I go through. It's, I think, a very striking, powerful piece of cinema. It's got a stellar cast. It's updated into a late 20th, early 21st century setting. It's filmed in Serbia and Montenegro, and although the setting is left ambiguous within the play, there's obviously all of the resonances to the Balkan Wars of the last part of the last century and the beginning part of the existing century. It's set in a kind of an urban scene of decay. The corruption is seen in terms of the particular ways in which people are living in certain instances compared to the patriarchs who are living in apparent luxury. And that there's some interesting parts where the film uses dialogue running across the bottom of the screen, sort of newsreel reports, which are telling you things that are happening, so that they don't have to have simply Shakespeare's words being spoken, but they can use words on the kind of like a Sky News feed across the bottom of the screen to give you various types of information. So at the beginning, we are told that this is a place calling itself Rome. We are told that they are having a border dispute with the Volscians. Neither of these phrases are Shakespeare's own, but it's a way of thinking and linking this to contemporary geopolitical struggles to give us a sort of another layer of resonance in terms of how that play is put forward. Now, the initial part, which I was very disappointed, is actually cut from the Ralph Fiennes version of this. The initial thing that talks about the idea of the body is something that's known as the fable of the belly. Now, this is something that comes up in relation to this question of the people being hungry and the people campaigning that the grain stores are opened in order that they can feed themselves instead of this being stockpiled away from them. And they're having an argument with the leader, Menaeus Agrippa, who suggests that it's the gods that have created the situation and that rather than carry arms against the Roman state, they should get on their knees to pray to the gods. And he tries to explain that situation to the people in terms of the relation of the different parts of the body politic and how those different parts feed on, benefit, serve each other in terms of their relations. Now, the Menenius line, where he's talking about the body's members rebelling against the belly, thinking about the way that the different parts of the body politic come together and the relations between those different elements there. And there's a number of phrases, verbs within that that are talking about these particular kind of bodily actions and the relation between those. And it's not a stretch, clearly, to read this as a corporeal way of thinking about the question of politics. But as you move through the play, as you move through this speech and the discussion that follows it, if you move into later parts of the play, these themes keep coming back again and again and again as the ways in which this relation between the people that make up a political community and the people that are ruling over them are understood. that the citizen is arguing, he's trying to understand what Menenius might be meaning in terms of this metaphor, this fable, around this idea of the body politic. And Menenius is talking about the way that the other members of the body are acting against the belly. The belly is the thing that cupboards, that encloses or contains the viands, stores the food, but it doesn't distribute it to the other parts unless it's absolutely needed in order to serve them, to keep them healthy, to keep them functioning, and so on. And that basic instincts keep coming back here: seeing, hearing, devising, instructing, walking, feeling, participating. They're not served by the belly's appetites and affectations. They're not being provided for unless it's at this sort of ultimate final instance in order to keep the political community working well. Menenius describes the complainants as discontented members, the multitudinous parts of the political body. He says that the belly is the root of this rather than the lungs. It's the belly that feeds rather than the lungs that allow it to breathe. And the citizen starts to talk about the various different parts of the body politic: the head, the eye, the heart, the arm, the leg, the tongue, many of which are things we still use when we talk about politics today, when we talk about the head of state, when we talk about the arms of the state, and so on. And this body politic idea is a recurrent theme in medieval literature. Shakespeare would have been well aware of this. The most famous medieval example is in John of Salisbury's Polycraticus. But the text that Shakespeare almost certainly knew at the time he was writing was Edward Fawcett's Comparative Discourse of the Body's Natural and Politic. And that this work was published very shortly before Shakespeare wrote the play Coriolanus. And so Shakespeare here is thinking about these questions in a context that relates to the idea of rebelling parts within the political community, of challenging against the political community. Fawcett was involved in the prosecution of Guy Fawkes, for example, and his fellow conspirators in their attempt on the body of Parliament and also the body of James I. Now, one of the things that's interesting, I think, here in this fable of the belly is not simply to stand as a metaphor for politics. I think it is that, but I think it's something more than that. The people in Shakespeare's plays are genuinely hungry. And this is an interesting thing that's a break from the source that Shakespeare takes from this, which is Plutarch and Plutarch's Life of Coriolanus. Now, Plutarch says this fable is told to the people outside of the city walls when they're actually complaining against money lending. They're complaining about the way that interest is being charged on loans and that people are exploiting them in that way. And that is when this fable is told to them as this kind of political metaphor. The grain riots in Plutarch's account actually come much later in the story. What Shakespeare is doing here, though, is compressing these two elements together. So it's people who are genuinely hungry complaining about the lack of distribution of food to them, to which this story of the fable of the belly, this kind of body politic and the feeding of the populace, is told to them. And the exchange of the fable continues in various ways throughout the play. The first citizen describes the patriarch as the cormorant belly. Cormorant was a bird that was understood to be a very ravenous bird, a bird that was always hungry, that was always taking more than it should. I suspect out of the relation of cormorants that were sometimes used for fishing, for example. And so it's talking about the way that the distribution of the things that are being sent, that are being passed through the rivers of the blood, going to the different parts of the political community from the centre. The people are only getting a little. They're only getting what the patriarchs deem them to be necessary or deserving of getting within this society. And Menenius is making this argument about how the senators of Rome are the good belly. You are the mutinous members. This is the way that we understand this. We know what's best for you. We know what you should be provisioned with. We know what you should be served with, to thinking about this. And the final line of there, the sort of the throwaway, the toe of the assembly, the kind of very last appendage to the bringing in together of common of people together in this political community. You find a number of other body parts being used to describe bits of the state or bits of that political community through the play. Now, this idea of hunger, and more specifically of cannibalism, keeps coming back through the play in a number of different places. But the play isn't simply concerned with the workings of the body politic, the workings of the body. It's talking about this largely in terms of a kind of a nourishment, in terms of the feeding off other things, of absorbing power or absorbing strength from those different locations. And it's been suggested by Stein Lagendorf that the physical is inescapable in this play, and yet it's an almost entirely unerotic play. Bodies are doing other things than the kind of the sense of an erotic body that might be found in some of Shakespeare's other plays. Here we encounter legs, arms, tongues, scabs, scratches, wounds, mouths, teeth, voices, bellies and toes, together with a whole range of actions such as eating, vomiting, starving, beating, scratching, wrestling, piercing and undressing. So bodies are doing a whole range of things throughout this play. And some of the questions that become most striking in this are precisely the wounds that are worn by soldiers after the battles they have fought on behalf of the state. Marcius, this is before he takes the name of Coriolanus, talks about, "I have some wounds upon me, and they smart to hear themselves remembered." But the politicians that want him to stand for public office think that the wounds that he wears on his body as a soldier on behalf of Rome are actually his kind of calling card. They're the thing that will allow him to gain that political office, because he can display these in a public setting which will allow people to recognise the sacrifices that he has made from this. So there's a discussion between Menenius, the patriarch of Rome, and Coriolanus' mother, where they're talking about a letter that they've received back from the front, which talks about the wounds that Coriolanus has received in the battle over with the Volscians. And it's talking about this in terms of a kind of a whole set of medical arguments here, talking about Galen, who was a medical writing from antiquity, who actually came chronologically after the time in which Coriolanus is set. This is one of many kind of anachronistic elements within Shakespeare's writing, where he gets his history slightly mixed up. But it's talking about this medical sense. It's talking about what's actually happening out of these ideas. The term here, empiricutic, seems to be a combination of empiric and pharmaceutic. And that Coriolanus's mother talks about how pleased she is to hear of all of the wounds that her son has received in this battle. "Oh, he's wounded, I thank the gods for it," she says. And Menenius continues, "So do I too, if it not be too much. It brings a victory in his pocket, the wounds become him." And then they have this exchange where they talk about all of the different places in which he's wounded, both in the past and in this most present battle, in order that these are the badges that he can display in the marketplace, in order to show the kind of almost a kind of a calculus of pain that comes from the battlefields that he can then expend in the political marketplace in terms of what this will allow him to achieve in a political register. Now the question, and this is one of the first things that Coriolanus breaks with what Rome expects of him, as a military leader he's been entirely successful, but Coriolanus refuses to show his wounds to the crowd. And this is where some of the other characters, particularly these two senators, Brutus in this example, talks about the fact that he's unwilling to do this. He wants to stand for consul, but he won't appear in the marketplace in what they call the napless vesture of humility, of taking off the clothes that he's wearing in order to show these marks on the body that he has received on the battlefield. And Coriolanus confirms this reluctance. "Your honour's pardon," he says, "I have rather had my wounds to heal again than hear say how I got them." And he asks to be excepted from this custom, that "I do not want to put on this particular gown that will allow him to effectively stand naked before them for my wound's sake, to give them their suffrage, to turn them into some kind of political capital that he can expend within this system." That he doesn't want to make that play of linking his prowess on the battlefield into his right to stand for public office. And that Seculius and Brutus see this as an affront. They see this as an affront to the political body, that he will not show his own heroic body to them in terms of the politics of the time. So Coriolanus says that he does not want to be part of these things, and that we have the argument from the senators about how they cannot force him to do this, but they say this final part of this line, that his ingratitude is monstrous, for the multitude being grateful were to make a monster of the multitude, of which we being members, being parts of this body, should bring ourselves to be monstrous members. So it's this idea that Coriolanus is turned into a monstrous body because of his failure to show the heroic body to the politicians, to the crowd. Now, one of the things that's interesting in terms of the play is in terms of the ideas of infection that continually come, so that the body politic is something that needs to be kept free from certain types of contamination. This may be contamination from the outside, or it may be a kind of a rot from within. So that we hear this continual line about the problems that are coming here through the idea of corruption, of pollution, of disease in terms of the political body. Kind of borrowing from Hamlet, we might say that something is rotten in this particular state. But here it's being used much more to relate to different elements or to different characters within the play. Coriolanus has described the crowd as making themselves scabs by rubbing the poor itch of their opinion. That Martius condemns the soldiers who are on the verge of defeating Coreliae in the following way. All of the contagion of the south light on you, you shames of Rome, you herd of boils and plagues plaster you o'er, that you may be abhorred further than seen, and one infect another against the wind a mile. You souls of geese that beat the shapes of men, how have you run from slaves that apes would beat, Pluto and hell? And it's this mixing together of these arguments against them, these curses directed towards them, but with these ideas of infection, of contagion, but also the animals that are starting to emerge in these quotations as the ways that people are being likened to particular kinds of beasts within this. And after being denied by the crowd, this is later when he's standing for political office, he again returns to taunt them, talking about them as those measles which we disdain should tetter us. Now, measles could be, of course, the modern disease of measles, but it could easily be leprosy. The words have confused etymologies, but it's some kind of contagious disease that is being talked about here. Tetters are skin eruptions. They're kind of boils on the surface of the skin. Again, a kind of an outbreak, a physical manifestation of some kind of infection or contagion within. And it's talking about the ways in which the poison that is within the system and how this might be continued or developed by this mutiny or this corruption within the political body. Coriolanus is described at one point as a poison. He's then described as a contagion. So this is the senators talking about him, talking about his failure to show his wounds in the public marketplace. What needs to be done is the question they're talking about here. So that one of them is suggesting that he's a disease that must be cut away. Menenius is trying to defend Coriolanus by saying, oh, it's a limb, so you can cut off this limb, and that would allow the rest of the body to be pure, to be free from these kinds of problems. But it's this argument here that they're talking about the idea of the blood that he's lost on behalf of the state. That is insufficient to outweigh the problems that he's creating through this contagion that they're suggesting. So that even though Sicinius the senator and Menenius the patrician who's trying to defend Coriolanus here, they're both using this same language of body, of blood, of infection, or of the kind of way that these things can be understood, even if they're differing on what Coriolanus should actually have done to him in this instance. Now, I've already indicated the bodies of animals that keep appearing through the play. The body of the people as a whole, the body of particular characters are described as animals, or kind of beastly bodies throughout. Coriolanus describes the people as a herd. Menenius talks about being the herdsman of the beastly plebeians. The people are described as the multiplying spawn. Coriolanus accuses one of these senators of being the Triton of the minnows. There are other insults used of the crowd. Coriolanus talks about them as go get you home, you fragments, you bits of something larger than you, you parts of an overall whole. The collective nature then of the crowd being described as the rabble or the shreds. And often these are in stage directions rather than just in speeches, and it's sometimes been suggested this actually starts to give you some indication of Shakespeare's own thinking around these kinds of issues. But there's a veritable bestiary beyond this. There's animals all over this play. There's curs, lions, hares, foxes, geese, Rome and her rats, Coriolanus mocking the crowd's hunger and their use of proverbs such as dogs must eat. And then he says, but you're not prepared to fight in order to create what you then want to eat. The Volsces say, he says, have much corn, take these rats hither to gnaw their garners. And later exchanges bring in a fawning greyhound, a cat and a mouse, mules, camels, dogs, sheep, moths, conies, an old goat, and a hen. Coriolanus continually talks about his soldiers in this way. I mentioned the souls of geese and the slaves that apes must beat a moment ago. He's also talking about this not being a gosling, not being a young goose that would simply obey physical instinct. Now, compared to some of Shakespeare's other plays, the way that animals are used is perhaps a little bit lazy. They're kind of often just invoked and thrown out there without much being done with the ideas. But the unfolding of these animal ideas and the bodies of those animals seems to be another register in which there's political bodies within this play. And one of the things that's interesting is how the animals often function as pairs. One of them is the hunter, the other is the hunter. One is the consumer and the other is consumed. That the animals then are frequently reduced down to their bodies simply to meat that is there to serve the appetites of others. And that Menenius says that people do not love Coriolanus. It's declared that nature teaches beasts to know their friends. Then the crowd is compared to a wolf that is looking to devour a lamb. And so there's a long argument then about whether Coriolanus is really somebody who is donning this wolfish toque, the civilian clothing that he would wear were he to become a senator, civilian dress covering his more martial instincts behind. And he talked about the way that war for him is a means by which he can rid himself of the kind of stifling atmosphere that he finds within political discussions. One of the posters for the Coriolanus film ties to this. This is the Aufidius character, played by Gerard Butler, talking about the idea that he is a lion that I am proud to hunt. He's a worthy adversary. Sometimes the animals are ones that are seen as noble, powerful, dominant animals, often as these unimportant, insignificant ones, or in that collective sense of herds, or as a group of rats, or of these smaller collective notions of animals. So while many of the contrasts are pejorative, there are also animals evoking strength and nobility, talking about the way that there might be admirable traits to animals which can be conveyed through the way of using those arguments there. The animal imagery is also, I think, interesting in terms of considering the relation of the people and the political leaders to the city itself, to the physical site of the city. In the opening scene, Martius, Coriolanus, before he takes on the title, suggests that the rabble should first have unroofed the city. And that's a claim, I think, that makes sense in a later context, where the senator's talking about this idea of kind of unbuilding the city, of laying all flat, and that one of the senators wants to suggest that the city is nothing but the people, it's nothing but the collective political mass of the people coming together. But then there's the arguments about whether the city has some kind of relation to the buildings, to putting roofs upon foundations, of creating some kind of space in which these bodies are as a collective, which is the thing that creates the idea of the city, and whether that can be reduced down to heaps and piles of ruin. But Coriolanus sees the common people as in Rome, but not Rome. They're not themselves Rome. They don't constitute the city simply through their bodies in plural, but they are people that happen to live within this site that is created by, the suggestion would seem to be, the more heroic deeds of the military rulers who have won on the battlefield. He says, I would they were barbarians, as they are, though in Rome littered, not Romans, as they are not, though carved in the porch of the capital. So he wishes that they were barbarians, people outside of Rome, people that are the external enemies of Rome that he could dispense with in a war. And he says at one point, on fair ground, I could beat 40 of them. But there's an interesting structure to these lines, with the wish followed by as they are, and the negative description reinforced by the as they are not, the two instances of though being used to qualify them further. There's a use of term here that refers to their mere bodies, the idea of animal procreation rather than people being born within the city, littered and carved. This is revealing the point. The plebeians are no more people that deserve to be called Romans than do the beasts that happen to live within the city walls to feed the population. But the contrasts, I think, go on deeper than that. The people believe that they are the city, whereas the politicians clearly see their physicality and the physicality of the city as the more important of those particular traits. The people care more about their own health, but Coriolanus, the senators, and other political leaders talk about the dangers to the destruction of the buildings, literally an unbuilding of the city. The city laid flat, a fallen fabric. And they talk about this idea of depopulating the city. That's an accusation that's made towards Coriolanus, this idea that he is a viper, again another animal figure coming through there, that Coriolanus sees the city could exist perfectly well without the common people that for others constitute and make up the city. I'm going to move to talk about the question of territories to close there. This is one of the plays in Shakespeare where that notion of territories does actually start to emerge. It appears in three places within the play, and there's certainly you could offer a kind of a geopolitical reading here in terms of Rome, in terms of this opposition from the Volscians, and in terms of the relation between Coriolanus's military power and the winning of the battles, and the threat that he then, towards the end of the play, poses towards the city of Rome. And he talks about the exile that is being proposed of him is something that he does not want to buy, that he does not want to have exile as this commuting of his punishment. He would much rather take the death, the throwing off the rock of Tarpeian, the particular mode of execution that was being proposed of him. That he doesn't want to have to be somebody who is expelled from the city, that the city is so important to him, he has sacrificed so much for the city, that he doesn't want to have this denied of him, the idea of his treason, as they would describe it, turning into an expelling from the body politic, of being pushed outside, of pushing that contagion or pollution outside. And so this idea of exile that's being continually suggested of him, the proposition that they don't kill their most famous military leader, but they expel him from outside of the city, but in that act, creating somebody who is the most dangerous towards the city, somebody who could defeat them, somebody who could turn his own military power or force back towards the city that came from him. And the people reply very enthusiastically to this idea that it shall be so, let him be banished, it shall be so. But there's an argument that happens just before he is actually forced out of the city. And this is between Brutus, one of these two senators that's been conspiring to get Coriolanus outside of the city, and Coriolanus turning this back on him. And so that he has this phrase here where he's turning back the banishment of him and saying that what he's actually doing in leaving the city is he is banishing Rome. That he is the one that is the position of power, and that Rome is now, without him, going to be defenceless, potentially against him, but certainly against the Volscians. So he talks again, that you common cry of curs, whose breath I hate, as reek of the rotten fens, the kind of external, outside of the city, whose loves I prize as the dead carcasses of unburied men that do corrupt my air, I banish you, and here remain with your uncertainty. For you, despising for you the city, thus I turn my back, there is a world elsewhere. This is the moment when he does go into exile, when he turns away from Rome and to move away. Now, when he does leave, he goes to the Volscian city of Antium. And in the compressed dramatic action of the play is written and the play is usually performed in a theatre, his journey is very short, and his arrival when he gets to Antium has to be disguised. It has to happen very quickly afterwards. But the recent film version shows this in a rather different way. The Ralph Fiennes character in the film is shown having a very long journey and with a clear passage of time being tracked through the journey. Coriolanus, through most of the play, has a shaven head and is clean shaven. As he moves through this journey into exile, his hair grows longer and longer and a long beard develops on his face. So that by the time he gets to Antium, there's no need for him to be disguised. The passage of time has changed his bodily appearance towards the people that he is encountering there. But there's geographical complications in that I think are interesting in terms of these questions. The play is set by Shakespeare in early Republican Rome, not long after the uprising against and the expulsion of the Tarquin kings. The play is written in the early 17th century and in England. The film is set in that kind of near contemporary pseudo-Balkans that I mentioned a moment ago. What's actually happening in this play? Where is Coriolanus as he is moving between Rome and the city of Antium? Is he still in this place calling itself Rome, or has he crossed the border and is he now within the areas controlled by the Volscians? So that there's that initial ticker tape thing that's going along the bottom of the screen talking about a border dispute, which implies a very proximate location between them, that they are meeting at a single point in the way that we understand a border today. You move from one place, you cross the border line, you emerge into the other place on the other side, and that the means used by the film at other points to mark this transition between land or terrain that is being controlled by military forces is done in a rather different way. There's a long road that they continually show with roadblocks set up on the road, and that these mark the front lines of the two opposed sides in this supposed border war. But what actually happens to Coriolanus is he's seen walking long distances, going through derelict landscapes, going through areas of kind of countryside, sleeping rough, moving through all of these places. But where is he at those points? Is he within Rome, or has he become part of the Volscian area? Now, it seems to me that in Republican Rome, it would have made sense to think about spaces that were not yet incorporated into territories, or not yet under the exclusive control of one of the political actors within the play. There would be places that were perhaps not yet spaces, lands that were not yet cultivated, not yet become territory. In the early 17th century, when Shakespeare is writing the play, it seems to me that he can effectively play with this spatial politics. Exile is still a punishment that's used by England at that time. Transportation of conflict into the New World or into slavery is still a common punishment. There's the arguments that somebody like John Locke makes at the other end of the 17th century about how the Indian knows no enclosure and is still a tenant in common, and lays claim, uses this as the basis on which you can construct claims to private property. Locke declares, and this is one of the things that makes Locke's argument possible, in the beginning, all the world was America, and not all places within Shakespeare's England were enclosed. Not all places were yet under an exclusive jurisdiction, an exclusive territorial or political control. Not in England, certainly not if you extended it to Scotland and Ireland. But in the late 20th century and early 21st century, in our time, in the time that this film version is set, something is interesting here about this idea of a place that perhaps isn't territory, a place outside of territory. It seems much harder to imagine, much harder to think about that question. So where is Coriolanus as he moves between those locations? Is he outside of territory, or is he still in some marginal parts of the territory of another side? It's hard, I think, today to conceive of a no man's land of such an extent that that passage of time in the change in his bodily appearance could actually be tracked in his movement through those locations. Now, when Coriolanus arrives in Antium, it's to talk about how he's been pushed into exile, it's to talk about the thing that he wants to do to get his revenge back towards Rome. And then there's this argument about whether Coriolanus should actually direct his forces in this way, that he should actually ally with the Volscians to attack Rome, to condemn them, to show the threats towards them. And there's a whole range of arguments where they're talking about the threat that he poses. And it's here that the question of territory, sorry, I'm going to skip over a couple here, the question of territory starts to emerge here, that the Volsces, with several powers and led by Coriolanus, are entered into the Roman territories. They're directed back, they're now a threat towards Rome itself. And that Caius Martius, now going back to the name before he was given the honorific name of Coriolanus, has associated with Aufidius, the previous enemy, the leader of the Volscians, to rage upon our territories. He's now a threat back towards the body of Rome, the body politic of Rome itself. And that Coriolanus then says that he has consent to let the Volsces plough Rome and harrow Italy. That is, to reduce it to a colony, or what the Romans would have understood as a territorium. There's an important moment in the establishment of a colony within Roman political practice where the ploughing of the sacred boundary of that city was, and this was a line that was known as the Pomerium. Now, we hear about this in Cicero, we hear about it in Varro, we hear about it in the historian Tacitus, and in the early Middle Ages, the Spanish writer Isidoro of Seville describes the etymology of the term territory from this precise practice, the ploughing of the boundaries of a city. A territorium, Isidore tells us, is so called as if it were a torritorium, that is, broken by a plough or ploughed by a team of oxen, torus, bull, being the notion of a torritorium, an area ploughed by a bull. And Isidore claims this is one of the ways we should understand the notion of territorium. It's areas that are marked out. He says the ancients used to designate the borders of their possessions and territoria by cutting a furrow. And that body of the ox in the physical act of ploughing the boundaries of the city even in the geopolitical aspects of the play, we see a kind of corporeal politics at stake in that. The idea that you can reduce these areas to a territoria of the Volscians as they dominate this area, Coriolanus's line of let the Volsces plough Rome and harrow Italy, the kind of agricultural corporeal politics that's being proposed there. Now, finally, Coriolanus returns at the end of the play to the very language that he's used throughout the play to talk about these ideas of contagion. He talks about this idea of a cankered country with the spleen of all of the under fiends. Aufidius comments on this by talking about the polluted body trope, by talking about the way that they can muster all from 12 to 70, this is the ages of the people, and pour water into the bowels of ungrateful Rome, like a bold flood overbear it. So again and again, these languages of bodies, of bodily functions tied to the political actions and contests within the play. And the key argument that's used by Coriolanus' mother to dissuade him from this political act is that what he is doing is marching on his mother's womb. She doesn't just mean her own, she means the womb of the city from which he was born, which gave him his political power in the first place. And Volumnia, the mother, is one of the most powerful figures in the play, talking about her herself in a kind of entirely self-sufficient mood. She's the one who bore Coriolanus within her own body, prevents his turning finally against the body of Rome, and she offers a line when she's invited to have a meal with somebody else, angers my meat, I'll sup upon myself. I'm so sufficient, I don't need to eat anything external. I will just live off the angers, the emotions that are boiling away inside of my own body. She says, and I shall starve with feeding. So Shakespeare, territory, bodies, these kinds of ideas. This is what I'm trying to do in this reading of Coriolanus as part of this larger project to think about different ways you can think about the question of territory and to use different Shakespeare plays to think through those kinds of ideas. It seems to me that the time Shakespeare's writing is interesting in terms of these questions. In my very historical work, I make the argument that territory emerges in a recognisably modern sense in the late 16th and early 17th century, the very time that Shakespeare is writing. Shakespeare then, I think, helps us to understand not simply the modern notion of territory, but variant aspects of political places. One eye to the past, one eye to the future. Some of the tensions, some of the ambiguities, some of the limits around the question of territory. And in other plays, he explores some of those limits in different ways. In The Tempest and the other colonial plays, about what it means when Europe comes into contact with its outside, with another. In talking about the outside of territory, in As You Like It and Titus Andronicus, the role that the forest plays in those plays as some kind of space outside of the ordered political space of a city. In his own England, at the time that he's writing, this is the late Elizabethan and early Jacobean period, a time that's generally characterised as absolutism, power conducted in a space that's relatively uncontested, and I stress relatively because there's all sorts of simmering problems going on that Shakespeare doesn't write about directly, but often reflects through his historical material some of the issues that are going on at the particular time he's writing. And in the Europe that's not very far away from the places that he's writing in, these kinds of issues are continuing. Shakespeare sets nearly all of his tragedies outside of England. They're all set in a number of other places, many of which have these contested political places as well as political actions within that time. In King Lear, there's a play that's historically distant and spatially disrupted. In Coriolanus, there's these political bodies and the particular ways that they're understood, but also that threat of vulnerability that Rome feels from the Volscians. A threat of vulnerability that I think also really shapes what's going on in the action within Hamlet and Macbeth. So in Coriolanus, territory as the body of the state is one aspect of the corporeal nature, a play about the political body of the polity itself, its inside, its outside, the aggressive wars to keep it safe externally, and its internal health and well-being. A number of questions about what it means to contribute to a political community, what it means to take from a political community, and who should rule. But literally and figuratively, there's a load of other bodies in the play, very physical bodies, very earthy bodies of the characters, language invoking wounds, contagion, animals, and a whole variety of body parts. And the overall argument I'm trying to make through all of these different readings is that Shakespeare can help us to understand what it means to be part of territory or outside of territory, and to help us to understand territory conceptually, historically, and politically. Thank you.